Can you describe the MET pathway and its role in oncogenesis?
So the MET tyrosine kinase has been known to be a key oncogene now for two decades plus, but we've had a hard time kind of understanding in exactly which, you know, cancer subtypes, you know, is it as important as targetable, actionable? The last couple of years, you know, we've learned though that, you know, with very special testing, we can identify a very particular alteration on the MET gene called MET exon 14, where an entire exon, kind of a building block of MET, is missing. And that's a key oncogenic alteration that basically drives overactivation, hyperactivation of this, you know, key MET tyrosine kinase pathway, thereby driving downstream processes, promoting angiogenesis, promoting metastasis, promoting invasion, yielding a very aggressive lung cancer subtype, you know, with this MET exon 14 alteration. And through that, we've also learned that now that we can identify this subset of patients, we can actually actionably target, you know, this alteration by available tyrosine kinase inhibitors, first crizotinib, which was ready made in a way already, you know, from the ALK, you know, experience, but now also more specific ones such as capmatinib and tepatinib that we can use for our patients in clinic, where we identify this key MET alteration, MET exon 14. And of course, MET amplification is another key alteration that, you know, we'll cover in just a moment.
What is the difference between the different MET alterations, amplification versus exon 14 skipping? What is the best method for detecting MET alterations, and when do you order these tests?
So now that we understand that there are certain subsets, especially lung cancer patients, you know, with MET alterations that we can treat, you know, with MET targeted therapy, it's so important to understand proper testing and where these very specific alterations, you know, make a difference. So one is MET exon 14. This is a very special oncogenic mutation. It's a primary oncogenic event. It occurs in about 3 to 4% of non-small cell lung cancers. It seems to be enriched in the most aggressive pulmonary sarcomatoid subtype, but you should test everyone, you know, for this with advanced non-small cell lung cancer. And this MET exon alteration sometimes happens concurrently with MET amplification. MET amplification on its own is a very different alteration, multiple copies of the MET kinase yielding a high expression and overactivation of the pathway seems to be the most important in the acquired resistance setting, and most prominently has been identified and validated in patients with EGFR mutated advanced non-small cell lung cancer. Upon progression on an EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitor, of course, nowadays most commonly osimertinib, MET amplification can occur in 10 to 15% of these patients, and now combinations of EGFR and MET targeted therapies can yield second responses, can provide significant benefits. So we need to think about testing for MET both upfront, you know, for patients with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer, but also at the time of acquired resistance on a targeted therapy to look for this special bypass mechanism of resistance that now that can be in a validated way targeted with appropriate you know, specific therapeutics. And we're seeing an explosion of therapeutics options that we'll talk about in a moment. Again, just highlighting the need to test. And the best way to test for these alterations capturing the whole spectrum is through next generation sequencing based testing, both on tissue as well as liquid biopsy based NGS testing can capture these, with RNA based testing potentially identifying some extra percentage of these alterations as well.
What are some pertinent MET targeted therapies available?
We're very fortunate. Just the last 2 years, we've seen the FDA to approve two excellent specific MET tyrosine kinase inhibitors, such as capmatinib and tepatinib. And these two drugs seem to work, you know, quite similarly. Both achieve a significant response rate, durability of response. Both are fairly tolerable agents with unique adverse events that a clinician will need to know about. For example, peripheral edemas, which are frequent with both of these agents and seem to be related to specifically MET targeting. So it's a class effect on a certain level. And you know what we're starting to note as well is that both of these agents seem to have CNS activity as well, which is, of course, very critical in the management of patients with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. So we're very fortunate to have now two approved, you know, compounds that you can use in clinic to the benefit of your patients. But there's also an explosion of novel agents as well as combinations that hopefully long-term will provide even more benefits to our patients.
Can you describe MET-targeted agents in development and associated clinical trials?
You know, we're very lucky to have many, many clinical trials ongoing, both with novel, you know, tyrosine kinase inhibitors, but also now novel classes of agents such as antibody drug conjugates, focusing on, you know, MET targeting, as well as now bispecific antibodies as well. For example, amivantamab, which is a bispecific anti-EGFR MET antibody, now is approved for patients with EGFR exon 20 insertion positive non-small cell lung cancer. But as we just learned at ASCO, it actually has significant activity for the acquired resistance, you know, MET amplification positive, you know, patients as well. So, you know, actually an agent that maybe we can start using in clinic for some of our patients, you know, based on this very promising experience. So again, an explosion, and you know, we'll be seeing combinations as well, both in the frontline setting, you know, with the MET targeting agents, as well as in the acquired resistance setting, with EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors, plus, you know, some of these novel agents. So be on the lookout for more success to come.
What is the incidence of KRAS mutations in non-small cell lung cancer?
So the clinical trials data of the two agents seem fairly similar. You know, the response rates, you know, hover around 40%. PFS is in the range of 6 months or so, median overall survival a year. So there's not a lot of distinguishing features between the two compounds. We're learning a little bit more about the CNS activity of adagrasib, as we mentioned, but we're not sure yet as to how the two compounds compare in that very particular department. Adverse events, of course, is very, you know, are very important to think about as a clinician to make sure that we maintain good quality of life for our patients. Both of these compounds have an array of, you know, adverse events that one needs to think about: gastrointestinal adverse events, which seems to be a potentially higher rate, you know, with adagrasib, as well as hepatotoxicity, other issues. But in general, with proper dose reductions, both of these agents, you know, seem reasonable in terms of everyday clinical practice. So I'm just glad that we have two compounds, you know, one FDA approved, you know, one hopefully very soon that, you know, we'll be able to use for patient profile that in the past really haven't had appropriate treatment for. Currently, these are for second-line therapy, not frontline. But, you know, clinical studies are moving into the frontline space. There's very exciting studies combining, for example, these drugs with immunotherapeutic agents frontline, and we'll have to see how those read out, and hopefully we'll be able to provide even better treatments, more effective treatments upfront for many of our patients in the future.
Are there any other mutations that we didn't cover in the top 10 symposium that with interesting targeted agents in development that we can touch on?
So of course, there's many other subsets of patients to keep in mind as to, you know, proper, you know, detection of those molecular alterations and targeting. And of course, BRAF is one of those, you know, happening about 4 to 5% of non-small cell lung cancers. There now we have, you know, potential targeting options with BRAF and MEK inhibitors. But we need to remember that BRAF mutations in non-small cell lung cancer come in different classes, and the currently available agents are only for the BRAF V600 mutations. Very specifically, these are the class one alterations that these combinations can help, you know, greatly, significant response rate, durable responses, really excellent outcomes for many of those patients. But half of the mutations in patients with non-small cell lung cancer are non-V600E, and these come in two different classes, class two and class three, and they have different biochemistry as to dependency on dimerization and kinase activity. But basically, they don't respond to the currently available agents. But now there's hope on the horizon with a number of different agents in development, such as KIM-2787, which is a pan-RAF kinase inhibitor with you know, biochemical proof, and hopefully, you know, soon enough, clinical proof as well, that they will be able to help patients with these non-classical, non-V600E alterations. And this is a substantial percentage of patients with non-small cell lung cancer. Again, about half of all BRAF alterations we see will fall into this category. So we need to be on the watch out, on the lookout for these drugs as well. We're hoping for significant activity. And this just underlines the critical importance of molecular testing widely. Now we have at least 10 different targets that we need to capture in our platforms, both upfront as well as we mentioned now in the acquired resistance setting as well. So molecular testing is key. Tissue-based, liquid-based, NGS is the key to remember. So make sure that you complete those.